Chapter 5. Long, long ago, when our street was the country, a stagecoach between us and London passing four times a day, I do not care to own that it was a sight of Flora Camisole's face under the card of her mama's lodgings to let, which first caused me to become a tenant of our street. A fine good-humored lass she was then, and I gave her lessons, part out of the rent, in French and flower painting. As he has made a fine rich marriage since, although her eyes have often seemed to me to say, "Ah, Mr. T, why didn't you, when there was yet time, and we both of us were free, propose you know what?" Shaw. Where was the money, my dear madam? Captain Bragg, then occupied in building bungalow lodge Bragg, I say, living on the first floor, and entertaining sea captains, merchants, and East Indian friends with his grand ship's plate, being disappointed in a project of marrying a director's daughter, who was also a second cousin once removed of a peer, sent in a fury for Mrs. Camisole, his landlady, and proposed to marry Flora offhand, and settle 400 a year upon her. Flora was ordered from the back parlor. The ground floor occupies the second floor bedroom, and was on the spot made acquainted with the splendid offer which the first floor had made her. As he has been Mrs. Captain Bragg these 12 years. Bragg to this day wears anchor buttons, and has a dress coat with a gold strap for epaulets, in case he should have a fancy to sport them. His house is covered with portraits, busts, and miniatures of himself. His wife is made to wear one of the latter. On his sideboard are pieces of plate, presented by the passengers of the Ramchunder to Captain Bragg : the Ramchunder East Indiaman, in a gale, off Table Bay, the outward bound fleet, under convoy of Her Majesty's frigate Lobbly Boy, apostrophe Captain Gutch, beating off the French squadron, under Commodore Leloup, the Ramchunder, apostrophe S. E.E. by E, is represented engaged with the Merliton Corvette, the Ramchunder standing into the Hooley, with Captain Bragg, his telescope and speaking trumpet, on the poop, Captain Bragg presenting the officers of the Ramchunder to General Bonaparte at St. Helena Titmarsh. This fine piece was painted by me, when I was in favor with Bragg. In a word, Bragg and the Ramchunder are all over the house. Although I have eaten scores of dinners at Captain Bragg's charge, yet his hospitality is so insolent, that none of us who frequent his mahogany feel any obligation to our braggart entertainer. After he has given one of his great heavy dinners, he always takes an opportunity to tell you, in the most public way, how many bottles of wine were drunk. His pleasure is to make his guests tipsy, and to tell everybody how and when the period of inebriation arose. And Miss Clapperclaw tells me that he often comes over laughing and giggling to her, and pretending that he has brought me into this condition, a calumny which I fling contemptuously in his face. He scarcely gives any but men's parties, and invites the whole club home to dinner. What is the compliment of being asked, when the whole club is asked to, I should like to know? Men's parties are only good for boys. I hate a dinner where there are no women. Bragg sits at the head of his table, and bullies the solitary Mrs. Bragg. He entertains us with stories of storms which he, Bragg, encountered, of dinners which he, Bragg, has received from the Governor General of India, of jokes which he, Bragg, has heard, and however stale or odious they may be, poor Mrs. B is always expected to laugh. Woe be to her if she doesn't, or if she laughs at anybody else's jokes. I have seen Bragg go up to her, and squeeze her arm with a savage grind of his teeth, and say, with an oath, "Hang it, madam, how dare you laugh when any man, but your husband, speaks to you? I forbid you to grin in that way. I forbid you to look sulky. I forbid you to look happy, or to look up, or to keep your eyes down to the ground. I desire you will not be trapezing through the rooms. I order you not to sit as still as a stone." He curses her, if the wine is corked, or if the dinner is spoiled, or if she comes a minute too soon to the club for him, or arrives a minute too late. He forbids her to walk, except upon his arm. And the consequence of his ill treatment is that Mrs. Camisole and Mrs. Bragg respect him beyond measure and think him the first of human beings. I never knew a woman who was constantly bullied by her husband who did not like him the better for it, Miss Clapperclaw says. And though this speech has some of Clapp's usual sardonic humor in it, I can't but think there is some truth in the remark. Leavened House Chambers. Mr. Rumbold, A.R.A., and Miss Rumbold. When Lord Leavened quitted the country and this neighborhood, in which the tradesmen still deplore him, number 56 known as Levanton House, was let to the Akakiran Club, which was speedily bankrupt, for we are too far from the center of town to support a club of our own. It was subsequently hired by the West Didlesex Railroad, and is now divided in two sets of chambers, superintended by an acrimonious housekeeper, and by a porter in a sham livery, whom, if you don't find him at the door, you may as well seek at the Rapes public house, in the little lane round the corner. He varnishes the japan boots of the dandy lodgers, reads Mr. Pinney's Morning Post before he lets him have it, and neglects the letters of the inmates of the chambers generally. The great rooms, which were occupied as the salons of the noble Levant, the coffee rooms of the Akakiran A Club, where the play was furious, as I am told, and the boardroom and manager's room of the West Didlesex, are tenanted now by a couple of artists, young Pinney the miniaturist, and George Rumbold the historical painter. Miss Rumbold, his sister, lives with him, by the way, but with that young lady of course we have nothing to do. I knew both these gentlemen at Rome, where George wore a velvet doublet and a beard down to his chest, and used to talk about high art at the Africo. How it smelled of smoke, that velveteen doublet of his, with which his stringy red beard was likewise perfumed. It was in his studio that I had the honor to be introduced to his sister, the fair Miss Clara. As he had a large cask with a red horsehair plume, I thought it had been a wisp of her brother's beard at first, and held a tin-headed spear in her hand, representing a Roman warrior in the great picture of Caractacus George, was painting a piece 64 feet by 18. The Roman warrior blushed to be discovered in that attitude. The tin-headed spear trembled in the whitest arm in the world. So she put it down, and taking off the helmet also, went and sat in a far corner of the studio, mending George's stockings, whilst we smoked a couple of pipes, and talked about Raffle being a good deal overrated. I think he is, and have never disguised my opinion about the Transfiguration. Dot and all the time we talked, there were Clara's eyes looking lucidly out from the dark corner in which she was sitting, working away at the stockings. The lucky fellow! They were in a dreadful state of bad repair when she came out to him at Rome, after the death of their father, the Reverend Miles Rumbold. George, while at Rome, painted Aracticus, a picture of an Anglicet Angeli, of course. A picture of Alfred in the neatherd's cottage, 72 feet by 48, an idea of the gigantic size and Michelangelesque proportions of this picture may be formed when I state that the mere muffin, of which the outcast king is spoiling the baking, is 2 feet 3 in diameter, and the deaths of Socrates, of Remus, and of the Christians under Nero respectively. I shall never forget how lovely Clara looked in white muslin, with her hair down, in this latter picture, giving herself up to a ferocious carnifex for which Bob Gaunter the architect sat, and refusing to listen to the mild suggestions of an insinuating flamen, which character was a gross caricature of myself. None of George's pictures sold. He has enough to tapestry Trafalgar Square. He has painted, since he came back to England, the flaying of Marcius, the smothering of the little boys in the tower, a plague scene during the great pestilence comma Ugolino on the seventh day, after he was deprived of victuals, and C4, although these pictures have great merit, and the writhings of Marcius, the convulsions of the little prince, the look of agony of St. Lawrence on the gridiron, and C are quite true to nature, yet the subjects somehow are not agreeable, And if he hadn't a small patrimony, my friend George would starve. Fondness for art leads me a great deal to his studio. George is a gentleman, and has very good friends, and good pluck too. When we were at Rome, there was a great row between him and young Heeltop, Lord Boxmoor's son, who was uncivil to Miss Rumbold.
The young scoundrel, had I been a fighting man, I should like to have shot him myself.
But Lady Betty Bulbul is very fond of Clara, and Tom Bulbul, who took George's message to Heeltop, is always hanging about the studio. At least I know that I find the young jackanapes there almost every day, bringing a new novel, or some poisonous French poetry, or a basket of flowers, or grapes, with Lady Betty's love to her dear Clara, a young rascal with white kids, and his hair curled every morning. What business has he to be dangling about George Rumbold's premises, and sticking up his ugly pug face as a model for all George's pictures? Miss Clapperclaw says Bulbul is evidently smitten, and Clara too. What? Would she put up with such a little fribble as that, when there is a man of intellect and taste who, but I won't believe it. It is all the jealousy of women. Some of the servants in our street. These gentlemen have two clubs in our quarter for the butlers at the Diamond, and for the gents in livery at the Ocklington Arms of either, of which societies I should like to be a member. I am sure they could not be so dull as our club at the Polyfloisboyo, where one meets the same neat, clean, respectable old fogies every day. But with the best wishes, it is impossible for the present writer to join either the late club or the uniform club, as these reunions are designated, for one could not shake hands with a friend who was standing behind your chair, or nod a how do you do to the butler who was pouring you out a glass of wine, so that what I know about the gents in our neighborhood is from mere casual observation. For instance, I have a slight acquaintance with one, Thomas Spavin, who commonly wears an air of injured innocence, and is groom to Mr. Joseph Green, of our street. Tell why the Brougham is out of condition, and why desperation broke out all in a lather. Osses will, this evy weather, and desperation was always the most mistest toss I ever see. I take him out with Mr. Anderson's ounce, I'm above it. I Alice was too timid to ride the ounce by natter. And Colonel Sprick's groom, as says he saw me, is a liar, and see, such is the tenor of Mr. Spavin's remarks to his master. Whereas all the world in our street knows that Mr. Spavin spends at least £100 a year in beer, that he keeps a betting book, that he has lent Mr. Green's black brougham horse to the omnibus driver, and, at a time when Mr. G supposed him at the veterinary surgeon's, has lent him to a livery stable, which has let him out to that gentleman himself, and actually driven him to dinner behind his own horse. This conduct I can understand, but I cannot excuse Mr. Spavin May, and I leave the matter to be settled betwixt himself and Mr. Green. The second is Monsieur Sinbad, Mr. Clarence Bulbul's man, whom we all hate Clarence for keeping. Mr. Sinbad is a foreigner, speaking no known language, but a mixture of every European dialect, so that he may be an Italian brigand, or a Tyrolese minstrel, or a Spanish smuggler, for what we know. I have heard say that he is neither of these, but an Irish Jew. He wears studs, hair oil, jewelry, and linen shirt fronts, very finely embroidered, but not particular for whiteness. He generally appears in faded velvet waistcoats of a morning, and is always perfumed with stale tobacco. He wears large rings on his hands, which look as if he kept them up the chimney. He does not appear to do anything earthly for Clarence Bulbul, except to smoke his cigars, and to practice on his guitar. He will not answer a bell, nor fetch a glass of water, nor go of an errand on which, a rest, Clarence dares not send him, being entirely afraid of his servant, and not daring to use him, or to abuse him, or to send him away. 3. Adams, Mr. Champignon's man, a good old man in an old livery coat with old worsted lace, so very old, deaf, surly, and faithful, that you wonder how he should have got into the family at all, who never kept a footman till last year, when they came into the street.
Miss Clapperclaw says she believes Adams to be Mrs. Champignon's father, and he certainly has a look of that lady. As Miss C pointed out to me at dinner one night, whilst old Adams was blundering about amongst the hired men from Gunter's, and falling over the silver dishes. 4. Phipps, the buttoniest page in all the street, walks behind Mrs. Grimsby with her prayer book, and protects her. If that woman wants a protector, a female acquaintance remarks, heaven be good to us. She is as big as an ogress, and has an upper lip which many a cornet of the lifeguards might envy. Her poor dear husband, and was a big man, and she could beat him easily, and did too. Mrs. Grimsby indeed. Why, my dear Mr. Titmarsh, it is Glumdalka walking with Tom Thumb. This observation of Miss C apostrophe S is very true, and Mrs. Grimsby might carry her prayer book to church herself. But Miss Clapperclaw, who is pretty well able to take care of herself too, was glad enough to have the protection of the page when she went out in the fly to pay visits, and before Mrs. Grimsby and she quarreled at whist at Lady Pocklington's. After this merely parenthetic observation, we come to 5-1 of her ladyship's large men, Mr. James, a gentleman of vast stature and proportions, who is almost nose to nose with us as we pass her ladyship's door on the outside of the omnibus. I think James has a contempt for a man whom he witnesses in that position. I have fancied something like that feeling showed itself,
as far as it may, in a well-bred gentleman accustomed to society,
in his behavior, while waiting behind my chair at dinner. But I take James to be, like most giants, good-natured, lazy, stupid, soft-hearted, and extremely fond of drink. One night, his lady being engaged to dinner at Nightingale House, I saw Mr. James resting himself on a bench at the Ocklington Arms, where, as he had no liquor before him, he had probably exhausted his credit. Little Spitfire, Mr. Clarence Bubble's boy, the wickedest little varlet that ever hung onto a cab, was halfing Mr. James, holding up to his face a pot of porter almost as big as the young Potiphar himself. "Will you now, Biggin, or want you?" Spitfire said. "If you're thirsty, why don't you say so and squench it, old boy?" "Don't go on making fun of me, I can't bear chaffin," was the reply of Mr. James, and tears actually stood in his fine eyes as he looked at the porter and the screeching little imp before him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.